The House Health, the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee is called to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Gordon moves approval of the minutes from April 1st, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from April 1st, 2025, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is approved, and the minutes are adopted for April 1st, 2025. First on the agenda this morning is Representative Anderson's House File 2963. As she makes her way forward, I will move that House File 2963. A clone bill to House File 1 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief. There's also a DE amendment.
Yes, and I will move the DE1 amendment. Are there any questions to the DE1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author wishes to present it? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. This is really just a hearing, so we wanted to bring it back before deadlines while the committee is still meeting. I want to give you an update specifically as it relates to DHS. So we've been meeting the House and Senate, essentially conferencing the bill as we go. We have agreement on a lot of it. Where we don't have agreement yet is whether it will be in the legislative or the executive branch and some police powers issues. So other than that, we've come to agreement on data issues, on a lot of the job duties, and on the things that will be moved. Specifically with DHS, because of the fact that their OIG, as it currently really has almost 500 employees, and they have employees that aren't really OIG functions, but they're under that OIG head in DHS, we're proposing to not move really any of them because they're really not OIG, you know, as we think of an OIG. That is in the bill, both the House and the Senate bill. I think there's one more discussion we'll be having with DHS about some of their top OIG staff as a final. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, that's where we're at. So this is a clone bill. House File 1 is in state gov right now. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 2963 as amended? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you, Representative Anderson. Appreciate the conversations that we've been having on this bill, the opportunity to work together with you and your caucus, with the Senate Republicans and the Senate Democrats on this. The DE that we adopted today does reflect some of that agreed-to language that we've been working on, and so I do think this DE moves the bill in the right direction. However, I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on this DE. The DHS language that's included in here I think is better than where we started, but I'm not convinced that it's finalized yet. We still have the issues with bargaining rights that are reflected in this DE in the House file. And then, as you pointed out, there's still some very fundamental issues with the bill, even, you know, what branch of government is this office going to sit within. So, I think this DE today reflects some progress, but there's still a long way to go, and I look forward to continue working with you and our colleagues in the Senate to try to get this into a position that we can support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nordis. Any other comments for the bill author or questions? Final word, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and thank you to Representative Norris, who has been at every one of our Tuesday meetings and working really hard, Tuesday night meetings. So we're going to get this done, I think. But it's, like I said, it's sort of being conferenced at the same time that we're working on this. We're trying to merge these files, or these two, the House and the Senate bill, and hopefully we'll have everything done before May 19th. So thank you.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 2963, as amended, be laid over. Next, we have House File 2040, Representative Nadeau. I will move that House File 2040 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Representative Nadeau, we have House File 2040 in front of us when you are ready.
There's an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will move the House, the A4 amendment. Are there any additions or questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment A4 is adopted. Representative Nadeau, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I'm going to do a quick introduction on this thing because I want you to hear from the testifiers because that's what's important about this bill. This is a county-connected youth bill that takes a regional and very innovative approach to serving children with mental and behavioral health problems. This approach brings together child protection, behavioral health services, and corrections and provides more access, focused resources with appropriate responses for children involved in our juvenile justice system. It expands the exception to licensed community residential settings only with a very, very narrow focus on children boarding in hospitals, and it creates a regional continuum of care for youth in our children's residential mental health licensing facilities. And with that, and I'm happy to go over the bill after this, but I want to move right to testifiers, starting with Commissioner Lundy.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Lundy, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Lundy, Hennepin County Commissioner for District 1, and had the honor of serving as co-chair of the Minnesota Legislative Working Group on Youth Interventions. I'm here in support of House File 2040. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about the acute need for a comprehensive approach to the issues of providing care for county-involved youth with complex mental health and behavioral needs. On October 1, 2024, the Hennepin County Board passed a resolution directing our county administration to convene a multi-county work group working with community members, other stakeholders, and providers, following up on the recommendations of the Working Group on Youth Interventions to develop a plan to address placement options for county-involved youth with complex needs in both human services and juvenile justice systems. The work group endorses taking a regional approach to this issue and ultimately developing a framework for advancing statewide system improvements. As the first step, the work group identified several legislative policy and funding proposals that would have both immediate and long-term impacts on maximizing capacity and better care for the young people who need it. In addition to supporting the work group, Hennepin County made a commitment to address one of the most acute gaps in need, youth crisis stabilization. Hennepin County is funding and opening a youth crisis stabilization center at our Behavioral Health Center located at 1800 Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis. The new space will serve youth with complex mental health and behavioral needs close to their home and families, regardless of which system they enter. This program will consist of 13 beds for short-term stays for 30 to 45 days with a target opening in late summer of this year. The Youth Crisis Stabilization Center is one piece along the continuum of care. The design and implementation of this center will serve as a demonstration how a regional approach can work. Lastly, this bill is a result of many counties coming together to identify legislative changes needed to provide youth in our care with appropriate placement and treatment options across the continuum. We respectfully ask for your support of House File 2040. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Lundy. Suwana Kirkland.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, chairs and committee members. My name is Suwana Kirkland. I am the Community Corrections Director for Dakota County. I am here today in support of House File 2040. Human Services and Corrections staff leaders from seven metro counties have come together to form a regional response to address the unmet needs of youth with complex mental health and behavioral issues. The goal of this regional response is to partner across counties to leverage the resources and experience of each county in different ways. Participating counties are in the process of forming a Youth Services Coordinating Board to oversee the work. The board will initially be collaborating on funding requests and legislative proposals to support improving the current care options, as well as inventorying existing programs and services and analyzing gaps. The Youth Services Coordinating Board will continue its work, building on implementing the findings of previous work groups within the scope of scale to available funding. Continuation of this work is not dependent on funding. Merely the scope and direction will be informed by the level of legislative support. House File 2040 will allow this work to happen, and we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirkland. Next, we have Suzanne Arntzen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Arntzen. I'm the Deputy Director with Scott County Health and Human Services. So thank you to the chairs and committee members for allowing us time today to speak to and support of House File 2040. This regional approach enables counties to collaborate effectively in addressing the needs of young people rather than competing for scarce resources. The framework takes a comprehensive approach to the issues, the critical issues our young people and their families are addressing through a range of services, including prevention strategies, crisis stabilization, the placement continuum, and aftercare supports. Funds requested would directly address the urgent needs identified by the work group and shared across the participating counties. Examples would include funding for therapeutic services and juvenile detention centers supporting young people transitioning back to their homes, funding facility infrastructure improvements along with prevention services. Key provisions of House File 2040 include four key points: establishing a task force to address a longstanding need to revise Minnesota Rule 2960, which governs licensing, facility licensing for children. This effort is essential in assuring that the rule is both effective and up to date. Number two, providing an exception to the current moratorium on youth beds would expand the capacity of licensed child foster settings, thus reducing a bottleneck by increasing placement options. House File 2040 would also allow for restrictive procedure licenses to be trauma responsive and include culturally appropriate practices. And finally, prioritizing the full implementation of the Consolidated Appropriation Act would direct DHS to allow and authorize payments for behavioral health services for eligible youth and correctional institutions. This provision would promote continuity of care, bridging the gap between institutional settings and community-based transitions. We ask for your support for House File 2040. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnston. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2040 as it was amended? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate people trying to find solutions. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you. I think it's a really good start. I do have one question. So I love the restrictive procedures piece talking about trauma-informed and culturally responsive. I'm wondering, given sort of the vision of this and what we're seeing the use of expanding, do we have any concerns about the Olmstead Act and interaction if kiddos are dual diagnosed and have that developmental disability? Just wanting to make sure that we're cognizant of how Olmstead plays into some of these things as we're changing rules and having conversations.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I'm going to see if there's some – Leah's not here?
You can get back to me, too, if that's
– And I can get back to you on that. And, I mean, that is obviously something that we're super concerned with, making sure this is – and this is a bit of a work in progress from the standpoint that we've got these counties in the metropolitan area that are coming together trying to address this increased need and how we can properly place and assess and kind of get the rigidness of the statutes out of the way, allowing us to deal not just with adjudicated children, but also with those children that are just involved in the juvenile justice system prior to adjudication. So I'll get back to you on that.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. We know that there's a lot of kids that are boarding for no reason other than mental health, and we also know that one of the biggest indicators of getting stuck is that you have coexisting trauma and a developmental disability. And so given the federal court case that Minnesota has lost repeatedly about how we approach individuals with developmental disabilities and some of the restrictions that are around that, I would really like to see some kind of very specific language around that or something to make sure that we don't overstep that line, because I don't know if you noticed, but we don't have any money to pay for another lawsuit. So,
any other questions or comments from members? Representative Momani Hitzley.
Thank you so much, Chair Schumacher, and thank you so much for, again, presenting an amazing bill, Representative Nadeau. And then I also want to acknowledge my commissioner, Jeff Lundy. It's always good to see you. And then resident of Brooklyn Park, Director Kirkland, for being here today. And I really want to just express, you know, the need for a comprehensive approach to addressing children's mental health. I think if we can center that around this bill, which I think you're doing a really great job of doing, I think we will be in a great place. So appreciate you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Momani Hiltzley. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple questions, because what happens is we create regional silos for what we actually serve at a statewide service. So I represent Clay County. We're working on a psychiatric residential treatment facility. We understand the need. Where my concern is that this bill and what you guys are trying to do is create a regional continuum of care with counties that we know in Clay County, we are housing 7 to 10 kids a week from Hennepin. And so it's a little bit concerning to me that when we are talking about continuum of care, we're only really talking about still this metro area. When the reality is we have kids from border to border that are getting serviced or getting services across the entire state. And so it doesn't make sense to me why we would only start a continuum of care within counties that we know you guys are either serving youth from outside of your county region, and then there's not really great efforts to get those kids or those families back into our communities because we know that that's when they're loved and supported best in their community. But also, we're serving your youth as well, and so can you let me know why we're not thinking about a more statewide network of support? Because Clay County has been in deep conversations with Hennepin County on how we create something together. This doesn't really address that. And I know, I know on my side of the aisle, I tend to be one of the only people who are in outstate bringing these issues up, but we're deeply trying to bridge this. So I don't know who wants to respond to that.
Commissioner Lundy.
Chair, Madam Representative, I would say I've actually been talking with commissioners from Clay County. During the Youth Interventions Working Group, we had feedback from all over the state, and one of the aspects was is that where state law precludes or doesn't encourage activities that we need, if we can get those changes done. And then I think what you're seeing as this framework was kind of like who goes first. And so having more wherewithal, I think the Metro said we'll go first. We have Olmsted, we have St. Louis County, we have Clay County watching to see where these best practices lie. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're going to see these systems really start to coalesce as we get this. But I think right now we're trying to prove it. And, I will just say this. Youth Interventions Study Group has a great report. One of the things we found was a report in 1997 that said basically the same thing. And so what we're trying to do is break that streak of identifying issues and not come up with solutions. So we are very much aware this is a statewide issue. We're very aware that we're all in this all together. And at no point have we ever said no one's welcome. And so,
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. That doesn't, I hear what you're saying, right? I know what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to advocate for the fact, you have Olmsted listed on here. So they're not really watching. They're part of the conversation. And to be honest, like the solutions you guys will come up with won't be a clean fit for my community. It won't be a clean fit for many of our communities. I have a massive border city issue. Like, are you guys going to be talking about that? And so as a committee, I know we have a lot of decisions that we have to make, and I won't go into this, but these are problematic when we're trying to solve a statewide issue when it comes to our kids, when they don't just stay within county. They go back and forth, and we have to figure out a statewide solution collectively together. I appreciate the work you're doing with Clay County. I just don't like the language in this bill based on the work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Any other questions or comments for the bill author or the testifiers? Final word, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler. And you're right, this is not, I am not a person that believes in one size fits all at all. But I also, I believe strongly in identifying those areas where we can work together, where we have to work together, and the concentration of kids that are in services is massive in the metro. We will welcome working with any county and trying to share what we learn. But these are kids that actually we need to have proper placements. We need to have a better approach. And this bill, all it does is open up the legislation to allow us to work more collaboratively together. And I don't think it's going to hurt going down the road as far as expanding that. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you hearing the bill.
With that, House File 2040 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, House File 2416, Representative Nadeau. I will move that House File 2416 be laid over for possible inclusion. And no amendment, Representative Nadeau, correct?
No.
All right. The bill is in front of us. Representative Nadeau, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me do two bills in a row. I really appreciate it, members. This bill builds on the priority admissions review panel work that we started a few years ago, and it continues the conversation about what we need to think about and how we go about keeping civilly committed patients out of jails or hospitals and instead admitted to medically appropriate treatment facilities. The highlights of this bill include that it ensures that counties are not responsible for the cost of individuals awaiting transfer to another state-operated program. It creates a dashboard so that patients awaiting transfer to a medically appropriated bed, along with their family members, program partners, and others, can see the number of individuals waiting treatment by program based on the longest, shortest, and average time on the wait list. It establishes a new priority admission timelines for 48-hour rule once direct care and treatment capacity is expanded, and it allows jails to bill the Department of Direct Care and Treatment for the cost of care of individuals that are sitting in jail or correctional institutions awaiting placement in a state-operated treatment program only after 30 days. This continues the work of Priority Admissions Review Panel to include supporting infrastructure that's going to increase our system capacity and starting to look outside along with the partners that we need to be part of this solution, like mobile crisis programs, county correctional facility, long-acting injectable pilot programs, existing intensive residential treatment services, and then looking at the local impacts of these things. Most importantly, this bill is addressing the need and acknowledging the need for increased capacity. 20% increase in forensic mental health beds, 20% increase in Anoka Medical Regional Treatment Facility beds, 20% increase in community behavioral health hospital beds. And this bill, like the previous one, is based on a group of counties and associations that are coming together, that are trying to work together with DHS to solve this incredibly complex problem. It's the Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Association of County Social Services, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and these people are working shoulder to shoulder along with Representative Frederick and his bill that is working on the same thing. So this bill is really this focus, and I think it's important for this committee to hear the testifiers and just know that we're all working together to try to solve this problem. With that, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers.
Okay, first for testifiers this morning, thank you, Representative Nadeau, is Terrell Clark on Zoom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. My name is Terrell Clark. I'm a county commissioner from Stearns County. I'm here on behalf of AMC, MAXA, and MICA, and I serve as a member of the Priority Admissions Task Force and Review Panel. This bill reflects the top priorities from our county statewide associations. While it does not mirror all the recent advisory panel recommendations, it does reflect the top priorities of our county coalition members. I'm going to highlight a couple of those. This bill specifically reflects a number of principles agreed upon in the review panel, including what a timeline for priority admissions creates, needing the urgency for the state to add necessary DCT capacity, and that changes in the 48-hour rule must only occur with increases in capacity at DCT and community. I would like to emphasize this. The task force only came to agreement, only supported extending the sunset provision around the 48-hour rule, conditioned on the legislature providing funding to increase capacity at DCT and in community. This bill would produce long overdue investment in increased capacity at DCT. I'd also, secondly, like to highlight in the bill, in sections 1 and 2, AMC and MAPS's priority to permanently fix the does not meet medical cost of care billing. It's inappropriate to charge counties when individuals at DCT facilities are awaiting transfer from one state hospital to another, from one state-operated bed to another state-operated bed. When delays in transfers are caused by lack of capacity in the DCT system, counties should not be charged 100% of the cost of the placement, which could be as high as $2,400 a day. A temporary reprieve in these DMC, that does not meet medical criteria costs, saved our counties across the state $10.2 million in 2024 alone. For Stearns County, my county, in 2024, this would have been over $500,000 in costs. If action is not taken by July 1st to fix this permanent the burden of these bills will once again be unfairly put on property taxpayers. These charges can bankrupt the county's behavioral health budget and are costs outside of a county's control to manage or avoid. We recognize the challenging budget dynamics this year, but it's past time to make these necessary investments in DCT and to stop inappropriately billing counties for does not meet medical criteria costs outside of their control. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. That was almost senatorial. Next, Angela Youngerberger. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and committee members. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Human Services Director of Business Operations at Blue Earth County, and I'm also MACSA's president. I'm here on behalf of AMC, MACSA, and MICA, and I served as a member of the Priority Admissions Review Panel. My testimony is going to focus on the need for additional DCT capacity and the importance of any change to the 48-hour rule being accompanied by such capacity increases. One of the guiding principles that we worked under is that all people living with mental health disorders are entitled to have care when and where they need it, and that people who have been civilly committed should have access to the court-ordered treatment that they require to achieve recovery. So the priority admission statute originated as a response to the lack of access and inpatient capacity at direct care and treatment, and it's a problem that still persists today that we've heard a lot about. As I shared with you last time I was here, there's a continued upward trend in the demand for priority admissions from jail to a direct care and treatment facility. There were 46 individuals admitted in 2013 under these criteria. In 2024, that number has increased to 424 individuals. That's who's been admitted, not necessarily who's still waiting. There remain persistent and significant waiting lists for priority admissions to direct care and treatment. And I just want to stress that this is the equivalent of ICU level of care for mental health needs. So we are letting people wait in jails for their ICU level of mental health care. The current average wait times to access beds at direct care and treatment for forensic services and Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center are simply unacceptable. When we look at the data for the last half of 2024, so a six-month span of time, the wait list or the wait average days to admission was 27 days for Anoka, and to the forensic program was 289 days on average. As explicitly stated by the review panel, any changes to the 48-hour rule must be accompanied by a significant immediate expansion of DCT's hospital capacity. I want to stress that DCT is maximizing who they can serve in their current facilities. They are doing good work, but DCT does not currently have adequate capacity, even for the most acutely ill people in our jails and our community. There is urgency needed to expand the state-operated system and our community capacity to meet the needs of individuals who are in jail waiting with the highest acuity. DCT serves those with complex needs in situations where private providers simply cannot or will not serve, and counties see DCT as an essential partner in that continuum of care. We recognize that DCT capacity is not the sole solution for our backlog, but we know it's an essential part. Unfortunately, we have failed to see an investment in direct care and treatment capacity from the state in recent years. DCT expanded capacity was not included in the governor's proposed budget or bonding proposals this biennium or last. It was not included in legislation the last several years. This bill importantly ties together the expansion of DCT with the changes in the 48-hour timeline. Capacity cannot be added overnight, but without investing in our beds now, we cannot hope for improvements in the backlog of our system in the future. Thank you so much for your time this morning, and I will stay for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Youngerberger. Mr. Magnuson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Noir, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Magnuson. I'm the county attorney in Washington County. I'm here representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and this is a great opportunity. Thank you so much for having us. This is a really important moment in time, and that prior to the task force and then this panel, the big chunks of the constituency of the stakeholders had never talked to each other about this. And they came together, and you have people now on all sides of the issue working together for a solution. I don't know when this has happened before. Everybody in the justice system, from the people running the jails to the public defenders to the people at stake to the county attorneys to human services to the commissioners, everybody is pushing in the same direction. And the problem is capacity. You know, the reason that we were all together is to solve the problem of the 48-hour rule. And it became quickly apparent that the 48-hour rule and capacity, that's the linchpin. Without developing capacity, without enhancing capacity, there would never have been any kind of agreement on this. And without that connection, this agreement will, this consensus will fall apart. We will not have the kind of support that we had in the panel and the task force if the legislation does not contain those two things. So any change, just to be clear, any change or pause in the 48-hour rule must be paired with capacity increases. And I know that's a difficult lift, but we need to make significant progress on capacity to show people that we're serious. I think the big question was, well, litigation is going to happen, but litigation is what's kept the pressure on this issue. And without at least the threat and some sort of deadline, this issue will continue to be kicked to the side, kicked down the road. It has to be solved now. The rationale behind the 48-hour rule is accountability and transparency. And the accountability part is you have to have some sort of deadline or, you know, inertia runs its course and people just don't get moved without feeling some kind of deadline. And the information part of this is, and we've had constituents who have come in and said, you know, my son has been in jail for, you know, 28 months or something crazy, you know, and I don't even know who to talk to. I mean, show me the wizard behind the curtain so I can at least have a conversation and try to reach out to the people who are making these decisions and tell them, you know, or find out what their rationale is. That's one of the things that this bill does. And so I encourage you also to take the public information part and the notice requirement to let the people who are in jail waiting know, because these are constitutional rights that are at stake here. This is not your average, you know, a typical kind of waiting session. These are people who are being held in jail and they haven't been convicted of a crime. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Next, we have Sheriff Welk on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Noir, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brian Welk, and I'm the current elected sheriff of Cass County. I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota Sheriff's Association, representing the 87 elected sheriffs of Minnesota. I also served as a member of the Private Admissions Review Panel. I'm here today in support of House File 2416. The issue of priority admissions, often referred to as the 48-hour rule, is one of the most critical challenges facing sheriffs across Minnesota. The law initially was put into place at the urging of our membership to establish a timeline for individuals suffering from severe mental illness who have not been deemed by the court as a danger to themselves or others. Now, these individuals should not be in county jails. They need professional mental health care and an appropriate facility. However, this is not what is happening, as there's not enough capacity. Minnesota's jails house individuals suffering from mental illness every single day. These individuals are not receiving the treatment they need to return safely to their communities. Some are severely mentally ill and dangerous, yet the courts have ruled through a legal process that they cannot proceed in the criminal justice system and should be under the care of professional mental health providers. From that point forward, we are now criminalizing mental health and mental illness simply because there is nowhere else for them to go. The 48-hour rule is not being followed. Instead, these individuals remain in county jails for 30, 60, 90 days, or even years, despite the law stating they should be transferred within 48 hours of a judge's ruling. This is simply not acceptable. The reality is that without necessary funding, upwards of $150 million in the first year and $70 million in the second, this crisis will continue. We cannot afford to keep kicking this problem down the road. Sheriffs do not want to house individuals with severe mental illness in jails. This is not safe for them. It's not safe for our staff. and it's not the right solution. We must do better. The work of the review panel has been extensive, with what help full buy-in from the legislature and administration to fund the necessary solutions, we will not see the change that Minnesota communities so desperately need. On behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, I urge you to support House File 2416 and make a real investment in mental health treatment capacity. Thank you all, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Sheriff Welk, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2416? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nando, and everybody that's came to testify. I appreciate that you're willing to show up and have this discussion. I'm going to start by asking the whole committee this question, but I'm specifically going to ask Representative Nando this question. If there's a bed that is available this Friday, let's say, only one, and somebody gets committed today, civilly committed today, and they meet the threshold to be civilly committed, but barely. Tomorrow, someone meets the threshold to be civilly committed, but it is the most extreme case of mental illness. They are constantly acting out and violent, hurting the staff that are with them, whether that's at the hospital or wherever their current placement is. Between those two people, who should be admitted to that bed on Friday?
Representative Nido.
That's the predicament we're in every day. I mean, and that's why this bill is so important. It's why your approach is so important. There's people making that decision every day, and it's not one person. It's a load of people, and they're residing in hospitals. They're residing in jails across the country. And so that's not a rhetorical question. That's what we're trying to solve. And that's the importance of this. This is a hard issue, members. This is basic investing in public infrastructure that doesn't get votes. It doesn't make all these people happy, but it treats people the way we need to be, the way they need to be treated. It lets people receive treatment in a medical appropriate way, and that's the challenge that we have. So I implore us all to work hard, and making those choices is difficult. This is one that we have put off for so long, and it's loading up, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. So I'm sorry I didn't directly answer your question, Representative Frederick, but it is the question that partners are answering every day.
Mr. Magnuson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the answer to your question, Representative Frederick, is both, all. I mean, the problem is right now it's just a triage process, and that's unacceptable. You know, if there's no expansion and the amount of people who need that service continue to build as this mental health crisis, as we've seen, continues to explode, the answer is both, all of them. And right now, when you have people who are waiting several months, you know, and decompensating in a jail cell, that's not helping anyone.
Ms. Youngerberger.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Frederick, yes, the answer absolutely is both. However, prior to July 1st, 2024, the technical answer would have been the first individual would have been admitted first because they were placed on the waiting list first. Then the second individual would have been admitted second because they were placed on the waiting list second. After July 1st, 2024, the Priority Admissions Task Force worked tirelessly through language to put into place a priority admissions triage process, which empowers the medical director and staff to make those decisions about triaging individuals with the highest acuity first. And so the way it was, again, prior to July 1st of 24 was first come, first serve. As of July 1st, 2024, one of the tools that was a result of the task force was actually empowering change in how people are triaged so that the most acutely ill receive treatment first. However, that does not underscore or does not undermine the first individual's need for access to care, which is why capacity is so critical.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does illustrate the point that we have limited capacity, and I appreciate that everyone's kind of advocating that we increase capacity. I would also then assume, Representative Nadeau, that with your bill that is increasing capacity, when a bill comes along next year, 2 years from now, that increases the budgets to DHS and DCT in order to pay for the staff and in order to run these facilities, that you would also be a very strong yes for those funding bills for those departments as well, because your bill is looking to expand that capacity, which I'm grateful for, because I think that's a space where you and I are aligned on. I think one of the things that's conveniently being overlooked, though, with this bill and by the counties, is that the rate of which there are civil commitments by the counties has dramatically increased. And so we are in a position where in the last, I think, what was the number, 15 years ago, on average, there was 45 people or so that were being committed a year, and we're over 400 now. And so now the counties are upset that we as a state don't have the capacity to commit and have bed space for that incredibly dramatic increase of civil commitments across the state. And they want to be able to sue the state to put that pressure, I think was the word, on the state for something that they are also responsible in helping create. And I can tell you from lived experience, from working in forensics, not all counties are the same. I've worked with individuals that have been civilly committed by the counties, and in the judge's order, the judge says, I'm tired of seeing this person before me, I'm civilly committing them. And that person would only get there because the county attorney would also be going after those individuals. So, yes, we have a capacity issue. Yes, the counties across the state have a role in that issue. And no, I do not believe the answer is for the counties to be able to sue the state and act like they are blameless in this situation. So there are good things in your bill, Representative Nadeau. I like the investment in capacity. The dashboard, I see value in that. But the thing that also worries me is if we are continuing to invest in capacity, what is stopping for the counties from across the state from civilly committing 600, 1,000 people next year or the year after that? What pressure is on the counties to curb any of those practices as well? I know that there are efforts in place to do that. And we do need to expand capacity, but we have to look at the picture as a whole. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Nadeau, I'm going to take a minute to say something that I've thought for a while, but I want to say it publicly. Thank you for, across the board, your commitment to taking care of folks least able to take care of themselves. I've seen this from you in so many different ways, and this, to me, is one more reflection of that. There is a ton of complexity in this one, like we talked about yesterday. Because these challenges are complex, the solutions will be complex. So I guess we're going to have to accept the fact that complexity will be part of whatever we do to try to resolve these things. Now, I like the fact that you're considering the view of both sides. There's so much expertise sitting around that side of the horn in the area of social services and the good work. So not only are you considering their viewpoints, but you're also considering legislation that they're bringing that would dovetail into your legislation. I think there's huge value in that. I think one thing that one of your testifiers said that raises this one a little bit to the top of our mind is the very fact that folks' civil rights are being violated. I don't like the idea of litigation to resolve this because we're all on the same team. We're trying to work closely with our counties and all of us to do the right thing. But where civil rights are being violated, where someone's incarcerated longer than they should be, that's a problem. The other thing that I raise as a question for this explosion of these folks being placed into these facilities, folks have come to me when I've met one-on-one with community members and said, do you know how many people are in our prisons or in our jails who really aren't criminals, who for years, for decades, have really had mental health issues? So I think there's kind of an epiphany going on, an awareness suddenly that, whoa, We've had a lot of people in jail that shouldn't be there. So I think that in and of itself, that awareness of we've had these folks in jail that shouldn't be there, that's going to make the number go up after that sudden awareness of that, that has occurred. And so I think if there's a question in here, it would be, I think along the lines of the cost factor that this will bring, are we ready to step up and manage that? And then to the point of, you know, what is the role on the county level? Can we bring some consistency of who would be sent to these kind of facilities? What are the criteria that have to be met at the county level to do that? So it's all about cost containment and then planning ahead for the cost. And again, I thank you for the broad input that you're receiving to make this thing work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. And just a note before I go to the final comments from Representative Nadeau is that our intent is to try and get a collaboration from the bills that we heard last week and the bill today to get the parties at the table once again to continue the conversation and hopefully have a little carrot and stick to get something resolved here that makes everyone just a little bit unhappy and a little bit happy. Representative Frederick.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, to that extent, too, I just want to say thank you again to all to Representative Neal and the counties. We had a very productive meeting yesterday, and we're already going to be coming together next week as well. So I just want to say thank you to everybody that's involved in that discussion, too.
Representative Frederick, final word. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, members, for the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill. There is not, and Representative Frederick is right, there's not a one size, you know, there's not a one solution to this. There's issues that we need to deal with, discharging out of those medical appropriate beds that the counties need to deal with. But make no mistake, the counties are paying the bill for this right now. You know, this is not just a problem in Minnesota. This is a problem across the country. We don't want there to be a $100 million injunction like there was in Washington here. We want to try to craft that solution to ensure that the investment that this state is making is working towards that, defending that action. And I look forward to working together with Representative Frederick and anyone else as we begin to solve this problem. So thank you again, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
That House File 2416 is laid over. Next, House File 1502, Representative Ryer. As she makes her way forward, I will move that House File 1502 be considered for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. We have the bill before us, Representative Ryer. When you are ready, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair Schumacher and Noor and committee members. House File 1502 is about making it faster for newborns to have access to life-saving treatment based on the results of their newborn screening. In Minnesota, we test for over 60 conditions that, if left untreated, can cause illness, severe disability, developmental delays, or death. Infants who test positive for congenital or heritable disorders often require urgent medical intervention. Newborn screening is most valuable when early detection is combined with prompt follow-up and access to treatment. Now, typically, these babies with these conditions end up on Medicaid, but the process can be very slow, so the time for optimal outcomes is lost. That's where Medicaid presumptive eligibility comes in. This expedited process allows for an immediate determination of Medicaid eligibility. This gives immediate temporary coverage while an application for health insurance is being processed. Minnesota's existing hospital presumptive eligibility, or HPE program for people who think in acronyms, permits participating hospitals to enroll patients in medical assistance with basic information like income and household size. This bill would extend the program to include infants with positive newborn screening results or a Social Security Administration compassionate care allowance determination. This will ensure that infants with urgent medical needs receive immediate care. Through this change, we'll see improved health outcomes, reduced cost, and increased efficiency in our healthcare system. And most importantly, we'll see less stressed families and healthier children. And now I'd like to turn it over to Representative Tom Murphy, my partner on the Rare Disease Advisory Council.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Ryer, for your work on this bill. I'd like to just echo some of the same comments. I have a situation that I didn't realize when I was made part of the Rare Disease Council. We have five kids, and three of them have rare diseases. It's called febrile seizures. And just to give you a little background as far as how the diagnosis went on that, at about 6 months of age, our oldest started having seizures. And we went in and we were told that, just to wait and maybe they wouldn't come back. And it went on for a while. We had lots of advice over time. But it wasn't until he was 6 years old we were told that we should really go to the Mayo Clinic and check it out. And they said, we're so happy you're here. Because the boy next to him was 20 years old, next to our six-year-old in the bed. And he said, if you had waited, it's likely that you would have a similar outcome. And that person's life was completely changed. So as of 6 months of age up to about 6 years, he would have seizures. When he was six, he was having about three seizures a day. And so what happened is we were able to find the diagnosis to help him. And that completely changed his life. So at 6 years old, we couldn't send him home with other families because they had to know what to do. And it was every other child of our five that had the same scenario. And to be a rare disease, you have to be under 200,000 in the United States to be there. Most people don't know what it is. And we were lucky to have an entity like the Mayo Clinic to go to and where they were able to help him. So now he's a mechanical engineer with SpaceX. It completely changed his life. And it taught us how to deal with number three and number five of our kids as well. So that's my story about rare disease. This is really important to the early diagnosis, and it's a life changer, and it can really change the cost that goes with families that have these problems too. So that's my input on it. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. For testifiers, the first one we have on the list is Dr. Paul Orchard on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. It looks like you're muted. Please unmute yourself. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Very good. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry about that. So my name is Paul Orchard. I'm a professor in pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. Very much appreciate the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Bill HF 1502 to establish a presumptive disability determination process for medical assistance. And particularly, I'm interested in the case of infants identified by newborn screening as well. My additional training was in hematology, oncology, blood marrow stem cell transplantation. Currently, my practice is focused on patients with rare inherited life-threatening disorders. I also have the privilege of serving on the Rare Disease Advisory Council. Many of the patients are infants affected with progressive, irreversible neurologic conditions. Minnesota has been a world leader in utilizing cellular therapies for these disorders. We were the first in the country to treat them with bone marrow transplantation. And more recently, we've assisted in international trials testing gene therapies, as we believe these may be safer and more effective than what we've been doing for decades. It's very clear to me, however, that to obtain the best outcomes for these patients, it's critically important to identify and treat them as early as possible. Earlier this week at our clinic, I saw three babies that have undergone gene therapies for the neurologic disorders. Two of them have metachromatic leukodystrophy, a progressive lethal neurologic disease, the same one that Erica Barnes' daughter was affected with. Both are recently treated with gene therapy, where their blood stem cells were removed, engineered to express the missing enzyme, aerosulfatase A. The University of Minnesota is the only institution in the country that thus far treated MLD with gene therapy, a total of eight thus far. One of the babies I saw Monday is a little girl born here in Minnesota. She turned one last week. A little boy who is here from Kansas is a few weeks behind in his therapy. But we learned Monday that his enzyme levels are now over five times normal, which is what we're trying to achieve. Both these infants with MLD are clinically doing very well. We had the opportunity to treat them early before they developed symptoms. Because we're not yet doing newborn screening for MLD, the reason we were able to treat them so early is because they had older siblings that were previously diagnosed. The little girl has older sisters who are now devastated by their disease. They're unable to walk or to communicate. The oldest is tube-fed. Her affected sisters will die of MLD as they're diagnosed too late for us to do anything. Little boy from Kansas has an older sister who was dead before her third birthday. The third baby I saw had a different neurologic disease called Krabbe, which is even more rapidly progressive. He, however, didn't have an older sibling who had died, as Minnesota is now doing newborn screening for Krabbe. He was the first to be picked up in Minnesota. I first spoke to the family Easter Sunday a year ago, few days after he was born. We were able to proceed with a blood stem cell transplant. Before he was a month old and he went on to receive gene therapy, we're really encouraged about how he's doing. But any obstacle to moving forward as quickly as possible to treatment puts patients at risk. There are many challenges in achieving that, and one I believe that would be important to take off the table is the insurance-based concerns. In my view, it makes little sense to decide to offer newborn screening to obtain an early diagnosis, only to delay a life-saving therapy because we can't expediently secure the necessary insurance. I would also add that these families are under tremendous stress after having been informed that their new baby has a life-threatening disease, and removing their concerns about insurance would be an important issue to take off their shoulders. I think this bill will help us do that.
Thank you, Dr. Orchard.
Yes?
If you could please wrap up your comments.
Very good. Newborn screening is a tremendous tool in our arsenal and effectively treating the disorders. I look forward to developing newborn screening for MLD, and I think that will happen soon. But for all these diseases for which newborn screening is available, it's my hope we'll be able to move forward as quickly as possible to give these kids and families their best chance for a meaningful, productive life. Minimizing barriers to obtain the necessary insurance will be key in achieving this, and I encourage you to support Bill HF 1502.
Thank you, Dr. Orchard. Ms. Barnes, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council. The Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council is a state agency whose mission is to provide advice to the state on improving care for the 1 in 10 Minnesotans living with a rare disease. One of our main priorities is to shorten the diagnostic odyssey, and we do this by working in an advisory capacity. We believe that working with MDH and DHS to strengthen our newborn screening program through both disease identification and efficient follow-up care is critical to achieving this aim. We've gotten technical assistance from both of them that has been very helpful. And I will just briefly say that due to the rigor of adding a disease to the newborn screening panel and the criteria that a disease has to meet, the RDAC believes that a positive newborn screen is a strong proxy for identifying children who will qualify for Medicaid through a disability determination. But because this determination process takes time, we think that establishing a temporary eligibility immediately while waiting for the final SMART determination will expedite delivery of care. And I can stay for questions.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1502? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions for the bill author or the testifiers? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, representatives. I heard this bill. I think it was in health. And I had a couple questions that I actually like want to ask you here because it's more in this jurisdiction. So I'm looking at the bill, for anybody who wants to follow along, 2.19 to 2.22. I just want to know how this works. It's the part that it says, for a purpose under this section, an individual with a household size, a child would be considered their own income. They don't take in the parents' income. They don't take in their own assets, because when a child is born, sometimes they have their own assets that generational wealth has provided. I'm interested to know at what point in this legislation would that child who's receiving MA without any of their parents' information, at what time frame then do they roll into needing their parents' information like all other children do to be eligible for MA? Or is it just until they're 17, they're always identified as an individual?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Keeler. This is a process that expedites the determination, but it is not the final determination of their eligibility. So they would do the initial, get the treatment started. It's presumed they'll be eligible, but then they would become, you know, and the agency can correct me if I'm wrong, but then they would go into the standard processes.
Representative Keeler.
Presumed eligibility, meaning that you think they will be on MA or you think there will be some sort of payment coming, because some people would be private pay for services.
Representative Ryer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, that they would be presumed because of the disability status that they are assumed to be born with, that they would be eligible for MA.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you. So okay, I understand where you're going. I still need a little bit of clarification on the actual time frame, because what we know, sometimes getting on MA can be months, right? And so, like, what I don't want to happen is a newborn bee receiving the care that they need, and then under this presumptive transition, we lose services. It sounds like this is a population that would be critical. It would be detrimental for them to lose services. So I think I'm just looking for a clear response that there would be no gap in service, but there is a timely response into the appropriate MA lane.
Ms. Barnes.
Chair Schumacher, if you so the way that the process would work is that the family would be presumed eligible through the hospital, but they would be required to apply for the disability determination. If they don't apply for that disability determination, the coverage would end at, I think, 60 days is what the bill says. But that coverage would last until the final disability determination is made. And they would then be it would be decided through the disability determination if they qualify for ongoing disability services.
Keeler.
And we're sure that that they would qualify based on the testing that we would do at newborn services.
Ms. Barnes.
So based on the, I would hesitate to say that every single child who would go through the presumptive eligibility process would qualify, but as a population, as I said, we think that the very nature of the way that that diseases are placed on the newborn screen, these are debilitating, life-threatening medical diseases. So we feel like that's a strong proxy for children who will qualify for disability.
Representative Keeler.
That's it. Thank you. I hope you know that it's really, I'm not trying to poke holes in it. I really just want to make sure that we never drop the ball in supporting the babies that probably need this the most. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Anyone else for questions or comments for the bill authors? Final words, Representative Murphy and Ryer.
Yeah, I can start out. The biggest thing is this, to looking at their screenings, that's what's prompting the whole thing. So when we see their screenings, we know we have to move fast, and that's why this bill is being brought forward. So we have that ability to do that in the short term until we can get other areas in line. So if you see that it's a disability because of the newborn screening, now we've got ourselves into the right position. That's why this is a good bill.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have nothing to add to that excellent close. I appreciate your support.
Very good. With that, House File 1502 is laid over. Next, Representative Knorr moves House File 2421 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Knorr, Chair Knorr, we have the bill in front of us. Whenever you are ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Knowing that we have got almost seven bills to go, House File 2421 establishes a council on direct support professionals. We understand that we're being challenged right now with workforce in that area. And so this bill just creates a council and establishes appropriate funding. Mr. Chair, I do have a testify with me.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, members of the committee. I'm Jesse Bethke Gomez, the Executive Director of Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. MCIL is a statutory nonprofit, Minnesota Statute 268A-01, Subdivision 8, Centers for Independent Living. I have worked on big healthcare issues throughout my career. I was on Governor Pawlenty's Healthcare Cost Committee in 2005. I was appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court to the at-large commission role of Minnesota Judicial Selection Commission. I have a great appreciation for the breadth and scope of your work and the breadth and scope of services throughout Minnesota. Since 2015, I was asked to serve in the capacity of how do we solve the direct care workforce shortage crisis. I want to acknowledge the role of the then Director of Disability Services, Alex Bartolik, then Natasha Merz, and currently the Director, Heidi Hamilton, for their deep commitment to assure that we continue to work forward. I was a technical writer for the 2018 recommendations report that was approved by the Minnesota Olmsted Commission. We have been following that report. There's 38 of us who have been meeting since 2018. And this council represents the best of how do we think about our direct care services and reviewing all of the state statutes. One of the things that we see is that recruitment and retention is at the point of providers. What we need to think about is how do we harness the power of post-secondary institutions to look at overall a strategic workforce for all direct care workers, for all of the lines of services, for children with disabilities, for adults with disabilities, for older adults. This plan looks to do that, and this also looks at, in the statute, an investment. What is our investment to address this issue? and what is the return on that investment? In 2018, we had a direct care workforce shortage of approximately 10,000 people. Today, that number is 53,000. So that is displacing people into long-term care settings. Skilled nursing home, on the average, is $153,000 per year. So the more we can go upstream, the more we can harness the power of workforce development, solve the crisis, put Minnesota on track. Let me lastly say this, that there are more older adults today than the last four decades combined. Yet at the same time, that number almost doubles by 2050. So this goes upstream. This says, how do we start working on this before this blossoms and explodes into a major issue so that we start to work at this issue today and help solve that crisis for tomorrow? Thank you so much for allowing me to provide testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2421? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions for the chairman or his testifier? Final word, Chair Knorr.
No further words, Mr. Chair. It's a good bill. Thank you.
With that, House File 2421 is laid over. Next, House File 2212. Representative Fisher moves House File 2212 to be laid over for possible inclusion. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Fisher, when you are ready, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair and Committee, for the opportunity to present House File 2212. Over the last couple of years, we've had funding provided last biennium. That was the first increase we've had in the past 20 years for senior nutrition. I'm hoping we can renew our commitment with that to senior nutrition with that. House File 2212 provides additional dollars for senior nutrition. These programs provide meals to older adults that are currently underfunded and not meeting the needs of our oldest who are living among us. As we've heard, our elderly population is growing substantially, and we want to make sure that we're meeting the needs. We want to make sure that people are not placed on waiting lists for these services. Lack of nutrition puts people at high risk for illness, longer lengths of hospital stays, and higher levels of readiness. Malnutrition is complex and driven by multiple factors, but the lack of access to nutritious meals is a key component. Meal programs assist in keeping people in their homes. Home-delivered meals provide older adults with regular in-person visit, and congregate meals create opportunities for gathering with others. I'd like to thank the Board of Aging and Minnesota Leadership Council on Aging and the other organizations serving seniors who are supporting this critical initiative. There's letters of support in the packet, and I do have one testifier, Jason Smith, co-chair of the Senior Meals and Services Coalition.
Mr. Swanson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher. Good morning, Chair Noren. Good morning, committee members. My name is Jason Swanson. I am the executive director of the Minnesota River Area Agency on Aging. I'm also the co-chair of the Senior Meals and Service Coalition. I want to thank you for your time today, but I really want to start by thanking Representative Fisher and Chair Schumacher for once again jointly championing this bill. This committee has been and continues to be a voice for older adults. This is evidenced by the committee's support of the 2023 Senior Nutrition Bill. That legislature approved a one-time funding amount of $11 million. Today, we ask to continue that funding for the next 2 years. We all share the necessity of a nutritious meal. Failure to access regular nutrition can cause complications for older adults. When an older adult becomes food insecure, their nutrition becomes a problem. The older adult misses out on essential proteins, vitamins, and other nutrients. This leads to negative health outcomes. This may include asthma, congestive heart disease, diabetes, malnutrition, and depression. These negative health outcomes are later addressed, unfortunately, and often too late, through an emergency room visit, hospitalization, skilled nursing facility stay, or may even be fatal. All of these are far more expensive than providing nutritious meals. The continued $11 million investment in the Senior Meals Program will assist in addressing older adults who are at risk of becoming food insecure with regular nutritious meals. Over half the counties in Minnesota currently have more than 20% of their population over the age of 65. Older adults lack access to nutritious foods, the availability of a food shelf, a grocery store, or a site that provides home-delivered meals. This leads to older adults being food insecure and declining in their health. The current senior nutrition environment is seeing service reductions, increase in wait lists, closure of nutrition sites, and the inability to resume services following the pandemic. With this environment, the AAAs and our providers are not prepared to meet the increasing demographics. The funding for senior nutrition is an investment and an empowerment for older adults to remain healthy, active, and engaged in their communities. We hear many times throughout the year how routine meal delivery has discovered a potential emergency for the recipient. They may have fallen earlier in the day. This may be the first time they're reported feeling ill, or they may have no heat or other utilities. The volunteer can intervene with minimal interference to continue to support that older adult. The funding we request would be integrated into the current aging network of the area agencies on aging and local service providers. The continued investment in older adults empowers them to stay active in their communities. Thank you again, Representative Fisher, Chair Schumacher, for your support and the committee. And thank you for the investment in empowering older adults to stay active in their communities. Thank you for your time. There was a gentleman, if I recall, from the community of Laverne. His name currently escapes me, but yes. No. I'll yield out that one.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I'd like to thank the committee for presenting it, and also thank you to Chair Schumacher for also being a co-sponsor on the bill. Appreciate it. This is a great bill. Looking forward to your support. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, chairs and committee, for hearing House File 1914, the Bridge to Shelter Act. And Chair, we do have an amendment before us.
Aye.
Thank you, Chair. House File 1914 will advance our collective goal of ensuring that no Minnesotan experiences unsheltered homelessness. The bill establishes three different buckets of funding. The first increases the current emergency services program. The second bucket is for counties and tribes. And the third would be for county-to-county capacity building. The reason for three distinct buckets is strategic and deliberate. Providers still need the access to ESP. We certainly don't want to touch that at all. They need it for their programming needs. Counties and tribes don't want to compete with providers for that funding. And so that's why we're establishing a separate pool of funding for counties and tribes in the A1, put the tribes on equal footing rather than limiting the funding to counties and counties with preference. With letters from tribes. It includes tribes in the process now. We do have several testifiers, so I will stop there and turn it over to them.
Well, good morning, Chair Schumacher. I want to thank you for hearing this important legislation and for the hard work and the important work that you are doing here today and every day. I want to thank you, Representative Curran, for being the chief author of this bill and for all of what you do and for the important work here on human services. So I am Ramsey County Commissioner Rena Moran, and I also am the vice chair of our Heading Home Ramsey County Continuum of Care. The Continuum of Care is a federally mandated coalition that includes more than 100 partners who work together to end homelessness, including service providers, in local government like the City of St. Paul, Maplewood, and Ramsey County. So I'm here today in support of House File 1914, which is a statewide bill bringing more funds to service providers and counties directly for this work. We see this bill as building off of the Pathway Home legislation from 2023 and the important work and the funding done here. Your committee has a tough but critical role to aid in the work to ensure that every Minnesotan has a safe and dignified place to call home. As many of you know, addressing our homelessness crisis is key to addressing our state investments. Safe, affordable housing allows Minnesotans to focus on work, education, and their health. Both Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul invested federal CARES and ARPA dollars, $74 million into more affordable housing, but also used some of that funding to fund the front end of the homelessness pipeline for emergency shelter beds and other critical housing support services, as well as the back end. And we are building 1,000 affordable housing units. You have heard similar statistics and commitment from my partners in Hennepin County. We are stepping up, but we need your continued help as counties, because we are coming to a fiscal cliff, and that cannot all go on the back of Ramsey County and counties across the state, and thus taxpayers. The timeline to bring those units online is a 3 to 5 year gap. And that gap, as well as the challenges to getting this work done without directly supporting counties, is what we are asking you today. The state, through this legislation, to help us do this work. We need your help with funding to ensure the work we've done on the front end doesn't slide back as we wait for our affordable housing units to come online. Of course, this bill also supports, in Section 1 of the bill, the work of our critically important providers, without whom, in partnership with the counties, couldn't make the positive impact that we are and need to continue. Also in Section 2 of the bill is the direct assistance to allow counties to continue their leadership to addressing the homelessness crisis through the continuum of care. We would apply and prioritize the following needs in Ramsey County, City of St. Paul. We would increasing the amount of emergency shelter space and diversity of programs to better meet the demands. We would like to maintain and expand extreme weather support to keep people out of the cold when shelters are full, and they do get full. We would like to expand navigation and support services to help people move from shelter to housing faster. Infrastructure planning to improve the housing referral system and expand the diversity of housing programs to youth, family, and single adults to improve accessibility statewide. And last, if we can make progress in funding Section 3, we can utilize best practices, shared experiences, and lessons learned to support our counties across Minnesota and support their unsheltered residents stay and thrive in their community. We know the importance of people who are unsheltered to be able to stay in their community, connected to the sources and resources and family members in their community. And we want that to happen statewide. So we want to thank you for your time today. I do have staff here. If there are questions about our housing stability or heading home Ramsey County work, thank you so much.
To figure that out, Rico Morales. You could please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. As you get settled in, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Buenos dias. Ustedes, me llamo Ricardo Morales. Good morning, everyone. I am Rico Morales. I am a member of the Hennepin County Lived Experience Advisory Group. I am here to testify and give you my testimony on this appropriations request. We have a lot of successes and victories in Hennepin County as far as housing and housing support services, but that only comes with the funding and the financing that we are asking for here today. With our efforts to end chronic homelessness in Hennepin County, the cuts from the federal government are affecting our work, and it's being a devastating blow to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans should never be homeless in anywhere in our country, and these support services are needed through this funding. We're asking for this money to support shelter staff, the Bridge to Shelter Act, and housing support services for people who are unhoused, people who are chronically ill, people who have mental health issues and who are difficult to house, such as myself, really. I am in permanent supportive housing, and I've been fully housed and fully sober for more than 14 years. And I really owe my life to all of you. I come here with gratitude and appreciation for the work that you're doing here today. The cuts that are happening federally and even here in the state as we look at our budget deficits coming up possibly, we can be the healing. We can have the funding for the financing that can be the healing for these cuts as well. And I'd like to remind all of you that you are in this with us together, and this appropriation is deeply needed across all barrier, across all communities and communities that need this housing and housing support services. This funding is crucial. It's extremely life-saving, and housing solves homelessness. Homelessness is solvable, and housing is a human right, and we should never, ever, ever really cut housing and housing support services, but this funding can be about the healing. You can help with the healing from these cuts. Whatever cuts are coming, whatever cuts may be happening. I really just want to say that I appreciate the time and the effort to come here and testify on behalf of many people who would never make it here today, people who are overdosing, are losing their vaccine clinics and their medicine, possibly with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health having some cuts as well. And I just want to say that when you support this bill and this appropriation, you support people. These are not just numbers. These are people and lives and families that are being supported with this funding. And we need this money, and we need this to be another victory in Hennepin County and the state of Minnesota as well. I think we're making great strides, and we're doing great things in Minnesota. And I think we can definitely keep doing better and better every day. And I thank you for your time. Thank you for any questions. I'm available.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. Good morning, Chair Knorr, Chair Schumacher, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to address the important issues surrounding homelessness and housing. My name is Reed Olson. I am the executive director for the Nameless Coalition for the Homeless. We operate two shelters in Bemidji, an emergency overnight shelter and a drop-in shelter. I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 1914. I'm in favor as a shelter director who has seen the number of people seeking our services rise precipitously over the past 5 years. We now serve an increasingly diverse group of people. Too many people find their ways to our doors who suffer from persistent and untreated mental illness, and we see too many elders at our doors with very poor health. Our 26-bed shelter routinely has over 30 guests a night. Our day center can see over 70 people in a day. The demands on our staff grow and grow. I was in St. Paul for the Homeless Day on the Hill early in March. As I was making the 4-hour drive south, a staff member of mine gave me a call about an hour before his shift started to let me know that he'd be quitting, that he just couldn't handle the job anymore, that his mental health was suffering and that he needed a break and needed to quit. The work our staff does is really demanding and it really takes a toll on my coworkers. I'm speaking in favor of this bill also as a former county commissioner. Counties are on the front lines in the fight against poverty. These funds will allow our counties to find solutions tailored to their constituent specific needs and facilitate the collaboration of diverse counties. They can share successes and caution each other against missteps. Minnesota needs to properly fund its shelter system statewide, but more importantly, we need to find and fund pathways to stability. This bill does both. You know, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless tagline is shelter save lives, but it is housing that ends homelessness. Please fund HF 1914 appropriately so that the shelters and counties can continue to improve their response to people experiencing housing insecurity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. And I have just a quick question for the author of the bill. So there's blank appropriations throughout the bill. Curious, you know, as it would be appropriating money from the general fund, what are you looking at for targets on the funding?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Gilman. Yeah, it was left blank on purpose, fully understanding the financial situation that we're in this budget season. Excuse me. Certainly, you know, one of the numbers that we had discussed was something like $12 million. But, you know, I think for the most part, this is something that is an idea that builds on a huge amount of work that was already done. And so, you know, not looking to put specific numbers in it, more so just looking to try to give the idea some consideration.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you again, Chair and members. Like I said, this work builds on an immense lift through the Pathway Home Act that we had last biennium. It gives us some ideas to think about. As this committee has stated, this is a statewide issue. For me, I think the best way that we can deliver services is making sure that it's getting to the people who need it the quickest. And so, you know, I see this bill as having counties trying to work with each other. Certainly there is a cost to counties that we don't want to put on property taxpayers. But again, I do think, you know, the more work we can do to get money directly to organizations doing the work, I think is our best bet. But if we were to have our ideal situation in an unlimited bucket of money, I think we'd want to fund organizations, counties, and I think the state has, regardless of the direction that we take this, I think the state has an obligation to make sure that the people who need funds are getting them. So, thank you.
With that, Representative Coran renews her motion. The House Bill 1914, as amended, is laid over.
All right. As Chair Schumacher makes his way to the testifier table, I will move that House File 2799 be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Schumacher, to your bill when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2799 is a $3 million appropriation for the Age Well at Home program. And to present today, Mr. Lund, on the work that is being done with this program.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, committee members, for having me. My name is Pat Lund. I'm executive director for Age Well at Home. We are a nonprofit housing provider serving older adults primarily in Minneapolis and St. Paul by modifying and renovating their homes so they can live safer, healthier, and longer in the homes and communities they love. Let me briefly give you some background on where we're at. So 40% of older homeowners in Minnesota are over the age of 65. Wilder research in 2016 found that over 32,000 older homeowners in Minnesota need home improvements to stay in their home. This research focused on older adults with income under $24,000 a year. That was 9 years ago. and it only covered a third of those who make under 50% of the state AMI. Okay, so the need likely today in 2025 is over 100,000 households that need this type of service. Less than 5% of our homes are age-friendly, meaning that on the main floor of a house, there is a bathroom, a bedroom, and laundry and kitchen facilities. So less than 5% of our homes are age-friendly. Falls are the number one reason why people need to leave their home. And so the work that we do is really critical to help folks age in place. Some of the most helpful modifications that we install are things like grab bars, handheld showers, improved lighting, extra railings. We use a lot of smart technology like smart lighting and smart doorbells. A lot of folks can't get up to answer the door, but with a smart doorbell, they can answer it with their phone. So all these things are really critical for people to be able to age in their homes. So the folks that we serve, they're our loved ones. There are moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas, and neighbors near and far. I'm sure many of us today have a story about a loved one that we've helped navigate staying at home. While home modifications and renovations are important to our work, critical to our success is the relationship we build with homeowners. Once we enter a house, we take off our contractor's hat and just listen. They tell us what makes their home special. They share about raising a family, that they love their neighbors, community, and their home, which to them is cozy, familiar, and full of memories. They also share that daily activities have become challenging to them. The time we spend to help people feel safe and build trust and create a successful work plan to install those really are going to help people to be able to stay at home. So for older adults, it's critical that we build this trust because they get a lot of calls every day to say, hey, buy this, do that. And so for us, it's critical that we take the time, build relationships with older adults. So the work that we do in the Twin Cities is not something that is new. Over the last 25 years, our staff have worked to impact thousands of homeowners locally, nationally, and internationally with Habitat for Humanity. I spent close to that time.
All right, Mr. Lund, we just have to wrap things up.
Oh, really sorry.
Thank
sorry.
You. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. Yep. So getting to the bill. So we are part of Age in Place Network. I think maybe you've got a handout with that, with the bill. It's basically 8 Habitat affiliates around the state that do similar work than what we do, and we're trying to build capacity. So we serve, last year we served 150 homeowners in the state. We're trying to double that with the $3 million to boost all of our production because the need is massive. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions? All right. Seeing none, final remarks on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say from my own experiences when I've worked at our local nursing home, a lot of the work I did was community outreach, trying to prevent falls from people so that they didn't have to come in and live in the facility that I was working in. And there was limits to what I could do because of, well, no one wants me using a power tool. And so it was just on the liability piece there. We didn't have the access to people like Mr. Lund, so you'd see the need, but you didn't have a way to fulfill that. And I think that this grant would be a really good way to help bridge some of that gap there when asked for member support.
Thank you so much. House File 2799 is laid over. All right. Thank you. Chair Schumacher, you have the next bill. Would you like to move this bill as well as the DE amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the I will move House File 2647 and to be laid over for possible inclusion. I will move the DE1 amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor? Opposed? Amendment passes.
Just barely, it sounded like. I'll work on that, Madam Chair.
Chair Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2647 is a bill that clarifies that licensed practical nurses can do tasks consistent with the Nurse Practice Act in assisted living settings and that they are already allowed to do in clinics, home care, and in hospitals. This change is not about lowering the standard of care, nor changing any current scope of practice to something new. This is about allowing skilled nurses to do a task that they are licensed to do under the Nurse Practice Act. The proponents of the bill received technical assistance from the Board of Nursing to ensure that this language was consistent with the LPN scope of practice and the MPA. This is also about pragmatism. Minnesota is short of about 5,600 RNs, according to Deed. Allowing LPNs to work to the top of their scope and training allows RNs in assisted living facilities to focus on the tasks and cares needed within their own scope and training. With the amendment, we clarified RN practice, LPN practice, and comprehensive assessments. A comprehensive assessment thoroughly evaluates the entire person, considering their physical, psychological, social, and spiritual health. While LPNs cannot independently perform a comprehensive assessment, they play a valuable and collaborative role in the assessment process by either conducting a focused assessment or participating alongside an RN in a comprehensive assessment. The amendment language creates clarification for nurses, providers, families, and other stakeholders on the role that the LPN may play. The language should be clear on any confusion that there was on whether LPNs may be a participant in a comprehensive assessment, even if they cannot do it autonomously. And now I would like to turn it over to my testifiers for further explanation.
Thank you so much. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Mattson with Care Providers of Minnesota and here today with the Long-Term Care Imperative. As we've stated previously in this committee, the long-term care sector is facing persistent workforce challenges. We have over 12,500 job vacancies, more than 2,500 of which are in the very critical nurse category. Now more than ever, the contribution of every single team member is vitally important. To that end, House File 2647 would allow a licensed practical nurse to conduct focused assessments consistent with their scope of practice under Chapter 148.171. LPNs are trained, licensed health professionals who have the ability to conduct these assessments. In this context, a focused assessment is completing a comparison of data to normal findings and the individual's current health status. They would have a previous assessment to reference. LPNs could conduct these assessments prior to AL licensure, and LPNs conduct these assessments in every other healthcare and home care setting. Changes in conditions are still required to be reported to the registered nurse per scope of practice, and an RN would still be required to conduct the initial assessment and perform any assessment upon a change of condition. Furthermore, restoring the credentials of the LPN to the top of their license may re-energize career pathways for caregivers aspiring to the nursing profession. The LPN role has historically been a stepping stone to achieve an RN license and more. This change is needed so LPNs can continue to have a role in our settings, and we want to leverage their skills and expertise to the benefit of our residents and ensure that they can work to the top of their scope. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, our next testifier.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert, also with the Long-Term Care Imperative. The imperative has attempted to restore this capability for LPNs in assisted living settings since, I believe, 2022. The version of the language you have before you as adopted by the DE1 is the product of additional conversations over the summer with the Department of Health, the Ombudsman, and other stakeholders. And it is my understanding that concerns have been addressed and that we may actually have resolved our differences over the summer. So it is my sincere hope that we have achieved that proverbial peace in the valley with this language. Thank you for your time.
Right. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify? All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gilman. Good morning. Pariche Rudina, Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. I do think we have achieved that peace in the Valley. The Consumer Advocates Coalition did submit a letter of opposition. However, with the maintenance of comprehensive assessments every 90 days and the amendment, our concerns are addressed, so we are happy to support the bill at this time. Thanks to MDH and the Board of Nursing for their technical assistance and Chair Schumacher for accepting.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member discussion. All right. Oh, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I think since we have the peace in the on the valley, maybe we should proceed and put this in the policy bill that is before us tomorrow. Just a suggestion.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I take it as a policy to not argue with Chair Noor when he's right, and so I would agree that this should go into the policy bill as well.
Wonderful. So final remarks to the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. All right, so House File 2647 is laid over. All right, our final bill is also Chair Schumacher. Chair Schumacher, would you please move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that House File 2646 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2646 would make the Governor's Council on Age-Friendly Minnesota permanent. This council was started in 2019, and in the bill you'll find three different components, the one that focuses on community grants, one that does technical assistance for grants, and finally the minimum staff requirement to administer these grants. And with that, I will turn it over to our testifiers.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Sherry Pugh, and I'm the chair of Age Friendly Minnesota. I'm here to speak in favor of the bill 2646. The Age Friendly Minnesota Council has built an incredible momentum since its inception in 2019. We are well established and actively at work with 15 council members and 4 staff. The council is made up of state agencies and 6 community members from around Minnesota. The council's work needs to continue uninterrupted. You just heard from one of our grantees, Live Well at Home, and we connect our grantees in this process. I'm going to talk about 2 things that we've done. One is the multi-sector blueprint. Over the past several years, the council has been working on Minnesota's first multi-sector blueprint on aging. This plan is a culmination of a great deal of work and contributions from many people, over 3,000 through surveys, 1,000 older Minnesotans participated, through 7 coordinated regional meetings, and then most recently 4 statewide meetings here in St. Paul. We've kicked off implementation of this 1 year, and now we're organizing action teams to work on the specific sections of this multi-sector plan, which will once again put Minnesota as a leader in aging in the United States. Our grants, our Age Friendly, have benefited communities from across the state. As I said, you've just heard from one previously. And in the second round of grants, which we issued in 2024, we granted $1.3 million. But the requests were for over 11. The need is great and growing. Our grants have gone for more than 100 entities, from small towns of 200 to school districts, nonprofit, and faith communities in the areas of aging. We're unique because we don't fund direct services. Our grants focus on changing systems and environments that will benefit us all. I will close by giving examples. in the cities of Lamberton and Halstead, Minnesota, we gave grants to these communities for repurposing public school buildings as multi-generational community centers. In Arrowhead region, we funded the Northland Foundation to develop returnship toolkit. This is an employment strategy for returning older workers to the workforce, and it's being used by employers successfully now, and you can go to their website and see it. I think it's exciting. And a third one, which is my favorite, I also am a city council member for the city of Mound, and we have a volunteer fire department, and our fire department spends more of its time now addressing falls, which you've heard also today in testimony. And so what we've seen is a new thing, and we had five fire chiefs attend our statewide meeting to bring their issue forward, and that is that people are falling. They're staying in their homes, but they're falling. They're falling in nursing homes and assisted living, and fire departments are being called. Mm-hmm. Now, that means that in a volunteer fire department like my city, that means 49 firemen are contacted. The first six that respond get on the truck and come to the house. But that's six people, along with a policeman, and later followed by the emergency services folks. So we know that people are going to fall. We're going to be about figuring out the solution through Aid Friendly. And I thank you for having us here today. Please support our bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify? Seeing none, testimony is closed. Member questions? All right, final remarks on the bill.
Thank you. I would just ask that the bill be laid over.
All right, House File 2646 is laid over. We are adjourned until tomorrow morning at 8:15.